All right, so welcome to the show, Megan. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to talk with us and share your experiences.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So to get started, I actually just want to maybe if we can give our audience a brief breakdown of kind of your running history, kind of where you started, kind of your progression along the way. That'd be great because I think it's an interesting story.
Sure. So I was, a pretty average runner in high school, as I think a lot of people were. I grew up in a very small town in East Texas, so I was fairly competitive for where I lived, but no, I was like a 12-minute 2-miler, so it wasn't like, my parents' phone was just ringing up with scholarship offers. So I did not go on to run in college. Interestingly, I did go to a school with a good Division I program. I didn't run for them. The track team wasn't really on my radar, and I certainly wasn't on theirs. I didn't run in undergrad, but I still stayed active, and my dad had become kind of a serious runner. And so he and I ran a lot just together. That's something I think that a lot of 18 and 19-year-old daughters don't necessarily have bonding opportunities with their dads, but that was something that he and I, both enjoyed. So I would, still run with him and do local 5Ks and that sort of thing. And then after college, I sort of realized that I wanted to continue potentially pursuing a career in the running industry or, just in the health and fitness industry. And doors opened up to where I was able to get a job with Mizuno in their running division for a year. And then after that, I went and worked for Brooks for 2 years, also, working within the running industry closely. And both of those are great companies, both also in a lot of people who were collegiate, and even post-collegiate runners. So it was very much, a lifestyle that was sort of ingrained within the job position. So I sort of began to get a little bit more serious about it and thought maybe I would actually start training to kind of see what, I could do beyond a 1935K. And so I guess that was around the time when I'd started dating my current boyfriend Jordan, and who, as you know, but obviously your viewers don't, was your teammate in college. And so Jordan knew that I was looking to get a little bit more serious, and he just said, "Oh, Jeff has nothing better to do, plenty of time on his hands. I'm sure he'd love to, coach you and spend hours per week, writing your training." So I
What I
reached
like to
out to
do.
you. Yeah, right. Nothing else going on. So I reached out to you via email. I think maybe we'd only met once before in person, but just asked, if you'd be interested in writing my schedule, and you very graciously you would. And so we started communicating just long distance over a few months with you writing some training for me. Again, we didn't really see each other in person, but I would just kind of report back to you my workouts. I guess at some point you discovered, two fairly important pieces of information. One, I wasn't terrible. And secondly, that, through whatever reason, I still had collegiate eligibility. And that was relevant because you at the time were coaching at a Division II school in North Carolina called Queens University. Division I and Division II have slightly different eligibility requirements. And so, for various reasons, I was still eligible to run Division II. All this was totally unbeknownst to me until one day you called me out of the blue. And literally, I think the conversation went something like, "How would you like to quit your job, move to Charlotte, get your master's degree, and run track at Queens?" And I'm pretty sure that, it was a few minutes of silence on my end while I tried to process everything that you were saying. And it was just such a ludicrous yet appealing offer that I kind of was like, "Sure, why not? I'll quit moving to Charlotte, and I don't even know what Queens is, but, I'd love to." In all seriousness, I knew at some point I'd like to go back to school and get a graduate degree and, to have the opportunity to do it in that way and to sort of see what, maybe my potential could be as a runner. It was just a great opportunity, that I pass up. And in hindsight, that really was the moment when, if you hadn't believed in me, and then later, Coach Simmons, who's the head coach there at the time, if you believed in me and seen some potential that I certainly did not see in myself, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation right now. So that's kind of where I would say, my running took a turn, sort of the tipping point, if you will, from just kind of a recreational but fairly competitively minded runner, but certainly with, pretty recreational times, to becoming what I would say, I am now, a more of a competitive, sub-elite, maybe you would say, type of runner. So that was really kind of the point that transformed my mindset a little bit.
And so you ran at Queens for 2 years?
I ran at Queens for 2 years. I had, with the way the eligibility worked, I had 3 seasons of eligibility, which was track, or excuse me, 2 track and 1 cross country sandwiched in the middle. I ended up being injured for the cross country, so that was a pretty underwhelming experience, but the first season of my PRs, I think perhaps my PRs going into it were something like, I'd run, you know, in the 18:20 to 18:30 range for 5K on the roads, and I never run a 5K on the track. And then 10K, again on the roads, I broke 38 minutes one time, and I was really pumped about that. That was, you know, at the time, a really, really fast
time. Yeah, it's a good time.
So then my first season at Queens, I improved to 17:27, which I ran indoors, and I ran around 36:10 outdoors, which at the time, you know, again, for me were huge improvements, but were not fast enough to even qualify for nationals. I think they were maybe provisional qualifying times, but, you know,
nothing
actually got me to the national meet. But, you know, I was encouraged, and I had seen that I was still improving quite a bit from, you know, certainly from what I had thought my original capabilities were. So then, as I mentioned, you know, that next cross-country season, I was sort of injured, didn't really do a whole lot. I came back just in time to compete with a team for nationals, and I placed an astounding 102nd place or something at nationals. So, again, you know, still not really turning any heads in the running scene, but, you know, I knew that there was more in me, you know, than that, of course. And so I then went on in the next track season. I believe my first indoor race in the 5K, I somewhat out of nowhere, to me, 16:54, which was a huge PR that qualified me automatically for nationals. Went on to get fifth place at the indoor national meet, which was, you know, All-American. Definitely for me, that was my first really successful kind of nationally competitive meet in that race with Tanya Zephyrjan, who is my teammate, who would go on to be a two-time outdoor champion. Neely Spence, who, you know, as your viewers probably know, had a very decorated career and just signed with INS. Sarah Porter, who went on to become a, you know, D2 10K national record holder. Lauren Kleppen, who is the current D2 national record holder in the 10K. She just ran 32:49 at Stanford. So, you know, it was with a lot of really talented girls and kind of held my own. So
that was
again, you know, another point where I realized that there was going to be more to it and more to my potential than I had ever originally thought. So after that, I went on to 10K outdoors less than a month later at the first Stanford meet. At the time, the automatic qualifying time for nationals was 35:30. Would have been, you know, from a 45 star from what I'd run before, but, you know, I thought I was fit, I thought I could do it, you know, if I went to the race and ran 35:29, I was going to be ecstatic, and I went in and ran 34:37, which ended up being, for the next month or so, the number one D2 time in the country, and honestly, for me, in hindsight, on the track, that is, you know, probably the best race that I've ever run. It was those races where you know, I don't think you appreciate those enough at the time.
Right.
You know, than not, it's the opposite where you're struggling your work. But that was just one of those magical Stanford nights, you know, when everything goes right. And so that season, I then went on to run 16:35 in the 5K, and ended up, you know, becoming a two-time All-American outdoors as well. I doubled in the 10K and the 5K. Was third in the 10K, and then came back a couple nights later and was fifth or sixth 5K, I believe. Tanya and I actually collectively ended up placing fifth as a team, and you know, which was sort of funny. Also funny because it was the highest that any sports team in Queens history had ever placed, you know, nationally anything. And it was just kind of, you know, me and Tanya out there. So that was. That was really special. And, you know, I remember, Jeff, when you asked me, you know, if I wanted to come to Queens, and after we'd sort of worked out the details before I came, you told me that you thought that I could be a national champion in the 10K. And I remember seeing that, it was a text message, and literally just laughing out loud at, you know, how absurd of an idea that was. At the time, you know, again, I was a 38-minute 10K runner, and it just seemed like, it just seemed absurd that you would even, you know, be saying something like that. And then ultimately, you know, it came within a couple of seconds of being reality. So I think, you know, that is definitely a testament to just how much your own expectations and your own perception of your capability can change within a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, because that was in about 2 years. You pretty much dropped your 5K PR by, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes, and your 10K PR by a good 4 minutes or so.
Almost.
Yeah, I mean, that must, how did you feel like every step that you took was kind of natural in terms of, you know, you kind of made gentle progressions, or did you feel like, especially in that first indoor meet that you talked about, and then the outdoor 10Ks, did you feel like when you got to that level that you weren't ready, or that you weren't ready to run with those? Did you have that confidence?
I think it was a both. I mean, certainly, if you look at the 2 years that I was at Queens, or the, you know, 18 months as the whole span of it, I think you would see a natural progression. Time, I think, and I actually wrote a blog about this a couple weeks ago, I think the two that stand out for me as what I would call like breakthrough performances were the 16:54 that I ran indoors, and then the 34:37 that outdoors. Just because, you know, at the time, again, that indoor five had been coming off a winter and a fall of just being injured. I'd missed like 9 weeks of running or something, which may as well be a lifetime within a collegiate season, you know. So I'd missed so much time. And when I went to 5K, you know, my PR again from the previous year had just under 17. I remember asking Jordan, my boyfriend, you know, what he thought would be a good goal for me at that race. And as you know, Jordan is, you know, he's very honest. He's not going to be the person that's gonna pat me on the back and tell me I'm doing an awesome job when I'm not doing an awesome job. And so I, you know, I thought he would be pretty objective with what he thought, you know, my fitness was at the time. And he said, you know, 17:15 would be a great goal. Like, that would be a nice improvement, you know, given what you've come from and, you know, your injury. And so for me to go through the first mile of that race in, you know, low 5:20s, I think my eyes were about to just pop out of my head. You know, it was one of those times where I knew I was, you know, out of my depth, but I was going to just kind of latch on and hang on for as long as I could, and, you know, had a great surprising result. And I think the same with the 10K, you know, at the time, Jordan had thought, you know, you could run 35 flat if you're having a good day. And even at the time I thought, no, you know, 35:20, like, that's a good, you know, good goal. And for me to go through 5K, you know, and 17:20 or whatever, and just feel like, you know, I'm getting stronger, not more tired. It's one of those things where you sort of know something special that's happening, and you don't want to jinx it, and you don't want to overthink it, so you just kind of go with it and let it happen, you know. And I think that's what those two races were for me.
Awesome. And then college, you moved kind of to the marathon.
I did.
Talk a little bit about how that experience went in terms of training and obviously your progression as well. Started in the marathon, technically.
Sort of, yeah. Well, when I knew to coach me originally, I was going to train for a marathon just because I thought that's what people did. You know, if you were an adult and you didn't run in college, you know, you probably just ran marathons. So that was my rationale for why I was going to become a marathon runner, but which is probably the same for a lot of people, incidentally. But, you know, so when I first started thinking about doing a marathon, when you began coaching me, whenever that was, five maybe, in my mind, like, a good goal was to break 3 hours. That was going to be something hard, but, you know, attainable, something that I felt was over time, you know, that I would love to say I ran 2:59 in the marathon. And then when I finished Queens and, you know, was still kind of riding that fitness and, you know, again, had totally transformed as a runner within the past few years, I think I knew almost immediately the next logical goal for me was to try to qualify for the Olympic trials. You know, I hadn't run that sub-3 marathon yet, so for people that would seem like a pretty ambitious goal. But, you know, again, I think my mindset shifted as far as what my capabilities were, and not just what I was capable of, but, you know, what I should expect myself to do. And I felt that qualifying for the Olympic trials was an amazing achievement, but something that sort of took the times I had run at Queen, type of training I was doing, should have been well within, you know, well within what my capabilities were. So that's what I set as my next, as my goal for, I guess that would have been 2011, you know, was to run a marathon and qualify for the Olympic trials.
Yeah. So kind of going into that experience, you first tried to qualify, and that didn't really go well. I only bring it up because I think, you know, the marathon is a really tough event, and you've run a few now, and perfect, even when you're really, really fit, is difficult. And I think a lot of runners, you know, from a 4-hour marathon to the elite, that even when you're perfectly ready to go, sometimes the marathon just doesn't go great. And your example of at Houston didn't really go well. And then you came back a couple weeks later and ran Birmingham, and ended up qualifying for the trial. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, what happened in Houston, you know, physically or mentally, and then, you know, how you got out of it and were able to qualify so quickly again after?
Sure. So in the fall of 2010, so this would have been, you know, 5 or 6 months after I finished my eligibility at Queens, I began training, and I picked Houston as kind of a goal race for several different reasons. You know, it's a fast course. I knew that's where the trials were going to be the next year. I'm mm-hmm. from Texas. My parents live there and come and watch us, and just a couple different things. And they had a great elite development for Houston that I was able to get into, you know, that was going to help with lodging and meals and, you know, mm-hmm. elite water like that. So it just, like, it was set up to be, you know, the perfect experience, the perfect opportunity for me to run, you know, the fine time. 44, 245 was going to be, you know, realistic goal for what I was in shape to run. And I don't think my workouts have been going great, but they were going well enough, and I'd done enough in a couple progressions to know that you should have been to run that time at Houston. Mm-hmm. And I got to the race, and, you know, Texas weather is notoriously mercurial, and so it was at Houston. Even though when traditionally it's very cold there, mm-hmm. I think race morning, you know, at 6 a.m. it was, you know, 60 degrees, 65 degrees, kind of muggy, drizzly. Mm-hmm. It just was, for me, certainly not the conditions, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not necessarily using that as an excuse, but I think that certainly played into why I just could tell, you know, by halfway, I could tell that it just wasn't going to be my race. I went through halfway, I think, you know, right at 123, so, you know, on pace to do what I'd come to do. But just within the next few miles, I think things did pretty rapidly. And, you know, I could just tell it wasn't going to be my day. And I ended up dropping out around 17. And, I mean, I was crushed. It was one of those things where, you know, my parents were there. I had friends who were there that had come to run the U.S. Half Championships that were the day before. So I had friends mm-hmm. that were there watching me. You know, I posted the track meet on Facebook. So I had everyone was following me. And It was embarrassing, to be honest. It was embarrassing, and it was almost like it kind of just pushed in, you know, maybe I'm not fit enough to do this. Maybe I'm not mentally tough enough. Maybe I'm not ready. You know, it was definitely a moment that made me question, you know, kind of why I was doing all of this in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I definitely had a pity party for a couple of days where I just was pretty discouraged about it. But a couple weeks later, actually exactly 2 weeks, I had to go to Birmingham, Alabama for work. I'm now for Carhu, which is a running shoe come back, which is the apparel come on. So we do events within the running, biking, fitness community. And I went to Birmingham to work the Marathon Expo for it's called the Mercedes Marathon, with the Track Shack, which is a specialty store there. So I went to work on behalf of Carhu to work the expo for a couple days. And so ever since I dropped at Houston, it was, you know, just a little seed in the back of my mind, like, maybe, you know, what if I just, you know, held on to this taper and this fitness and everything else and just gave it another try in Alabama. So the 2 weeks between the races, it was another one of those, again, kind of those strange experiences where every run I did was awesome. Like, I felt terrific on every run, easy runs, fast runs, short runs, long runs. It was just, it was kind of unnerving because I don't normally have 2 weeks in a row where just everything feels great. So that's, you know, kept building in my mind of, you know, maybe the timing is going to be right now. And I'm great friends with the owner and the store manager at Track Shack. So they were, you know, perfectly willing to help me, you know, get a free entry. And so, you know, I was even able to hold the day before to kind of make the game time to see whether I wanted to do it. So I ended up, you know, signing up and decided I was going to run, and the whole atmosphere and the whole lead up was so different than Houston in terms of how laid back it was, how last minute. You know, I spent the night at my friend Brooke's house the night before. You know, I didn't have the fancy hotel. You know, I think we bottle of wine and she made dinner. You know, it wasn't the typical pre-race dinner. I slept in my friend's bedroom. She dropped me off the starting line. There were no pace groups. There were no water bottles. You know, there were no, you know, 100 spectators there or whatever. It was, you know, just kind of me seeing what I could do. I didn't post it on Facebook. You know, I only told a couple of friends in advance that I was even going to be doing this because the last thing I wanted was another disaster and another round of, you know, the condolence emails and the condolence wall posts. So I sort of just slipped under the radar and hoped that it was going to be a good day. And it was a great day. I ended up, you know, everything went smoothly. It's a pretty difficult course. Birmingham is just a really hilly place. So
right.
by no means, you know, I would say actually it was quite a more difficult course than Houston, but it was cold. It was, you know, the weather was clear. It was just one of those days, you know, again, where everything goes well. And I definitely, you know, the last couple miles, I was definitely hurting and definitely ready for it to be done. But I, you know, had done the math well enough in my nose. I got with to 2 miles to go by a certain time, mm-hmm. and I could just hold it, you know, another minute that it would happen. And so when I realized that it was a, definitely an amazing feeling of accomplishment to realize, you know, I had to kind of hang on and see what could have been, you know, and what was a disastrous experience at Houston and turn it into yeah. something really, really positive.
Yeah. And so what did you end up running in Birmingham?
I think my 2:45.00 or 2:45.01. It was like right on the dot. So I was about a minute under, you know, the B standard for qualifying.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's, like I said, I think that's really an amazing story that I think people can really relate to, because it's, the marathon's tough and you don't always get it right. And so it's reassuring to know that, you know, you can definitely, in terms of being able to put it behind you. And I think a lot of something we talk a lot about with athletes is, you know, pressing the reset button. And I think you kind of did that, you know, you gave yourself a case to give yourself a pity party. And then it seemed to press the reset button and things seemed to work out pretty well. And also going into the race relaxed, you know, not having this big hoopla about it. Do you think that really helped a lot, or do you think it was just kind of coincidence, or...
Yeah, I don't think, you know, at the time that was the option, like how it was, but I think mm-hmm. certainly it certainly didn't hurt. I think just, you know, again, going into it, you know, knowing everyone who had thought I qualified, you know, thought I was going to do it 2 weeks ago. So it wasn't like I had any, the only expectations really were from myself, honestly, mm-hmm. you know, even if I hadn't tried, you know, my parents wouldn't really have cared and my friends who love me wouldn't have really cared. You know, it wasn't like everyone was, you know, counting on me for this huge, but for myself, you know, and again, for the expectations and the level that I thought I was capable of mm-hmm. certainly was, you know, it was definitely a redemption run for sure.
Yeah. And so your next marathon after Birmingham was the trials itself?
Yeah, so Birmingham was February of 2011, so it was about 11 months and trials, and I mm-hmm. thought potentially about doing a fall marathon, but to be honest, Birmingham, it took me a little bit longer to recover than I thought. I think I was a little over ambitious afterwards. I felt pretty good on the race, and I mm-hmm. didn't give myself enough time to recover, you know, kind of back into normal training fairly quickly, and then, you know, ultimately 2 and 3 months later, I was just not recovered, the bottom line. You know, my workouts weren't going that well. And so it really gave me a, you know, a newfound respect for the distance and for, you know, anything that it encompasses both before and after the race. And so I just knew that, you know, unless I wanted to really set aside another 6 month block, you know, to devote mm-hmm. just to the marathon and the post marathon, it just didn't really make sense for me to do another full marathon before the trials.
Right.
So that's what I decided. I did, you know, some races in between, some halves and 5Ks, 10Ks, different things, obviously to keep myself, you know, competitive, but mm-hmm. the trials was my next marathon. So it was almost a year after I qualified.
Yeah. And so the training, how was the training leading up to the trials? Did it kind of go perfect, or were there a lot of hiccups in the process?
It's never perfect. But actually, you know, another thing in the time frame, we were living, Jordan and I were still living in Charlotte at the time. Mm-hmm. We'd stayed there after I graduated from Queens. And then in, I guess, October of this past year, October of 2011, relocating, that's where Carmen, mm-hmm. Promotion, gotten a job position within the company that sort of necessitated us being at the home office. So we moved up to New England, which, mm-hmm. again, myself being from Texas and having only lived in the South was a huge adjustment. Malise Jordan had gone to school in Rhode Island, so he knew what the winters were going to be like, and he knew,
right.
you know, what we were getting into. So we moved kind of midway through or even at the beginning, you know, of that marathon training cycle, which was, it was okay. difficult. You know, I had training partners, you know, I had two, Caitlin Chrisman and Megan Hobus, who I trained with in Charlotte, who would also mm-hmm. had qualified for the trials. So we worked out together. Caitlin's one of my best friends. Charlotte Running Club, which is, you know, I had a great network of people that I ran with every single day. I could, you know, I could find someone to run with. I could find someone to work out with. And then we moved up to Boston, actually more to kind of a suburb area of Boston where, you know, it was really just Jordan and I doing a lot of the work for a while. And it, you know, it definitely changed. We had to adjust to new places. Obviously, the climate was different.
Right.
You know, not having that network of training partners. So mentally, more than anything, that was tough. I mean, I still got the workouts done. You know, we still made it happen. But but that took some adjustment. And then along the way, I sort of began to develop some friendships with the BAA and some of the coaches and the athletes there. And so now I've started slowly to develop that same kind of friends and training partners here in Boston.
Right.
Much of the trials training, you know, is kind of Jordan and I by ourselves. I had some in comparison to training I did before Mercedes,
mm-hmm.
a lot more long runs. I think I had maybe 5 or 6 runs of 20 plus miles going into trials. Before Mercedes, I think I had one. one which also doubled as like a marathon simulation. So it was like a workout and a long run. That was 3 weeks before. So, you know, I had 5 or 6 really solid long runs leading up to the trials. A tempo run that Jordan led me on that was, it ended up being like tempo, really rolling hit terrain, mm-hmm. Windy, bad weather. And I think I ran like 6:05 pace. On the one hand, it was a confidence boost. On the other hand,
right.
Jordan reminded me I would still have another 20-something K to run at that pace afterwards. So
He's nice.
Yeah, it brings you back to reality. But, you know, a couple things like that where I just had some good tempos and some good workouts that really really started clicking. And so we had sort of decided, as I'm sure you do sometimes with your athletes, you know, if we set kind of a range of goals for mm-hmm. what I would like to do with the trials, you know, my number one goal, don't finish last. number two goal was, you know, to run a PR. I think, you know, I'd run 2:45, so I wanted to run faster than that.
Yep.
But honestly, what I really thought that on my best case scenario, best day, I thought I was capable of running sub 2:40, 2:38 to 2:39. That was sort of like mm-hmm. my dream scenario for what I wanted to do at the trials based on, you know, it didn't come out of nowhere. It was based on kind of a combination of my workouts and several other indicators that said, you know, hey, if you have a great day, like, potentially be what happens.
Yeah.
spoiler alert, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. Yeah, so talk about the race, how it went, how you felt.
Yeah, so the trial, I mean, first and foremost, the experience is just amazing. I think probably, you know, 90% of the people who compete at the trials, at least at the marathon trials, they realize they're not making an Olympic team anytime soon. Like, they realize that they're just there for their own goal, for their own you know, experience. And certainly, you know, I was one of those. Like, I had no illusions of grandeur. I want to kind of soak everything in. I mean, of course, I do hope that I'll qualify next time and maybe even the next time after that, but you just never know when it's going to be, you know, your once in a lifetime opportunity. And so
right.
Caitlin and I and Megan, you know, my other friend from several other friends, really just kind of soaked everything in and enjoyed the atmosphere and just being in the presence of so many other amazing athletes, you know, where I think it's interesting, especially when we were in Charlotte, you know, I was one of the better runners there. And a lot of the runners in Charlotte and in the Charlotte Running Club, you know, would look to myself or to Jordan as, you know, the pinnacle, the top tier runners. And I think, you know, it would be interesting for them and certainly is humbling for us to go to an experience like that where, you know, we're the bottom of the bottom tier scrubs that are just lucky to make it there. You know, I think that illustrates how it's all relative, you know, just kind of a theme of you know, my training and everything throughout all my racing experience is just, you know, the better you get, like, the more you realize that there are people better than you, you know,
right.
And that's certainly like what the trials was for me, but it was an amazing experience to be there. The race itself ended up going pretty much as planned. Caitlin and I and my friend Allison Maxis, who runs for Team Rogue Elite, which is out of Austin, we had all had a similar goal with similar shape, and we really wanted to kind of foster like a group dynamic of working together. You know, unlike a lot of the marathons that people had run to qualify, the trials doesn't have, you know, any type of like a pace team or a pace group or anything that's trying to get you on a certain time. So we wanted to create that for ourselves. Like, we were going to be the 2:39:59 pace group, you know, sort of kind of what we wanted to be. And the way that the course was set up at the trials in Houston was a little bit different than the actual Houston Marathon course. With the trials, they obviously wanted to make it more spectator friendly. So essentially what the course was you started and did a 2.2 mile loop just like within the downtown. Then you passed through the start finish line again. And then you went out on three big loops that were 8 miles. And so when you had an 8 mile loop, you would cross the finish line for the final time. So, you know, our goal, I think, was to just try to, you know, build the group and foster the group mentality. You know, going into that first big loop, you know, after the first 2.2 miles, everyone kind of settles down a little bit. And you sort of see who's around you. And so Caitlin and Allison and I were able to get, at some point, to as many as, you know, 8 or 10 other girls that were kind of all running together and clicking off pretty consistent, you know, 6:05 to 6:10 pace, you know, pretty consistently, maybe a few small outliers in there, but that was pretty much clicking it off. We went together through two of the big loops, so that would put us at about 18 miles. And at that point, that's when everyone sort of, you know, their own role and their own race really starts. And so we started to string out at that point. Allison and one other girl sort of began to pay for me a little bit. At the same time, Caitlin was sort of falling back. But we had really helped each other out for, you know, the majority of the race, which was huge. And just really special, I think, you know, again, especially for Caitlin and I, who had done so much of our training together. This had been such a goal of ours for a long time. It was just really special. I think something that, you know, can never be recreated, the bond that comes from having that sort of experience together.
Yeah.
So the last 8 miles was a struggle. You know, my math skills were failing me a little bit, but I could tell that I probably was not going to come in under 240. It was close enough that, you know, it wasn't out of the question. I think we had gone through halfway and 120, it was 120 something. So it was still potentially could happen if I knew it.
Right.
That just didn't quite happen. And like, gosh, I remember the last 5 or 6, just feeling the step was a struggle. I just knew I was running at a pace. You know, when I look at the splits afterwards, I actually was maintaining the same pace, which I think is another kind of valuable lesson to learn, that, you know, you can feel fatigued and like you're dying, but your body kind of knows, you know, what it's capable of and knows what it's doing. And if it's locked in that rhythm, even though you may be, your brain may be screaming at it to stop, it can sometimes continue to do that. And what also sort of surprised me and kind of gave me, I guess, the mental fortitude to keep pushing was I was passing girls left and right in the last 6 miles. And I just remember thinking, like, as terrible as I feel, you know, and I'm still passing people, like, gosh, some people must be feeling like they're having the day of their lives. And I think Jordan said I passed something like 20 to 25 girls in that last loop.
Wow.
At one point, I heard someone say, just a spectator that was counting said, you know, that I was in 54th place or something like that. He'd given me a frame of reference for where I was. And at that point, I was like, okay, I may not be able to get sub 240, but finishing in the top 50 would be a huge accomplishment. Like, let's just see if I can pick off a few more people, you know, in these last few miles. And, you know, for all I knew, he wasn't paying attention or hadn't, but I could have been in 74th place, but I was just trusting that he was telling that I could use that as motivator. And so somehow I managed to do that. I passed one final girl just literally a second before crossing the finish line and ended up finishing 49th. I ran 2:41:05 or 2:06, I believe. So it was, you know, a 4 minute PR pretty much from what I'd done before. And initially, you know, I was a little disappointed. Like I said, I had set this high bar that I really thought, you know, I could run sub 240. But it was interesting, you know, a few days later, just reflecting and looking at some of the data, how many people dropped out, how few people PR'd relative. I think I read somewhere it was maybe only 38 women had run PRs at the trials. And so for me to have, you know, been included among them, I think once the initial sort of disappointment, you know, subsided and I really had more perspective, I was really pleased actually with how I competed and how I performed.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
My parents actually got to see me finish a race. So that was pretty big. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's good redemption, you know, getting your parents to see, and obviously everybody knew you were there. It was Houston again. So kind of full circle from the previous year. That's pretty cool.
It was. Yeah.
I guess kind of moving on a little bit, I mean, obviously, that's a great running history, and you mentioned that you work for Kraft, Karu, so you work full-time.
I do work full-time. I mean, I don't know how many hours a week necessarily, you know, 40 to sometimes more. I tend to do a lot of events and traveling for the company, so I'm not always your typical you know, 8-to-5 office job, although I do that sometimes during the week. But a lot of times I'm on the road, I'm in different cities. That actually, you know, when you asked earlier about maybe challenges with, I remember one week when I was doing, that was supposed to be my high week. It was like 100 to 105 miles. And I was on a business trip with one of our sales reps in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was doing, ended up doing, you know, some, a fartlek basically on a sidewalk, like in downtown Louisville, because you're staying, you know, I had a 6 a.m. flight the next day out of Nashville. I got up, you know, flying to do 10 miles treadmill in the Nashville airport. And then, you know, I flew home and my parents were visiting for the weekend. You know, they were flying in the same time I was flying in, which was wonderful. But at the same time, obviously, like, you want to be respectful of them visiting and not spend the whole time training. And right. I just remember thinking, like, if I get, you know, 50 miles this week, it'll be a miracle. And somehow that actually ended up being one of my best training weeks. You know, I hit 100 miles. That was when I did the 20K progression with Jordan. And yeah, so, you know, a lot of look at my schedule and see where I'm traveling and what I'm doing and just think, you know, man, there's no way I'm going to get the training in. But in some sort of way, that almost is a challenge that I use to motivate me is like, hey, it's going to be impossible to do what you need to be. Like, now figure it out, you know?
Okay.
So it can be difficult with traveling. But, you know, again, fortunately, I'm lucky to work in an industry that is essentially also my hobby and, you know, my pastime. And, you know, I often get to travel to races and, you know, I'll work the event and then, you know, get to run the race as well. You know, something that wouldn't have been, you know, if I was in a different career, and just to be surrounded by other like-minded people all the time. And, you know, people who understand health and fitness, my company's really supportive of my training and my goals. So it's definitely, I think, a blessing just to be in this and to kind of surrounded by running. And again, by people who understand what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the audience probably understands where you're coming from the travel perspective. obviously, you know, just even the small stories that you told, you know, getting up at 3 a.m. and, you know, doing fartleks on sidewalks. Obviously, it requires a lot of dedication and I'm just on a train. I'm sure there are a lot of mornings you were just like, I want to get out of bed. But, you know, other than the dedication thing, do you have anything, that strategies that you use in terms of, like, when you're traveling a lot to be able to get your runs in?
Yeah, always, you know, now I sort of travel to places, that I've been to a couple times before, so it's helped me to get a lay of the land. But if I'm going to a new place, I always try to go online in advance and figure out some place to run. I hate running on the treadmill. That time in Nashville was maybe one of three times in the year I've run on the treadmill. So I always prefer to find some place to run outside. So, you know, sometimes I'll just search on the Let's Run message boards or even on Runner's World, or just do a Google search, or, you know, I'll call the local running store and just see where they suggest that you can run. If I'm, you know, again, if I'm working with a running store, sometimes I'll see if there's someone there that wants to meet up for a run, or someone who, you know, is available to train with me. So I just try to kind of plan it in advance and get an idea of, you know, where I can. And Jordan, my boyfriend, is coaching me now, which is nice because he, of course, understands my travel schedule.
Right.
So he understands the flexibility that sometimes is required when, you know, sometimes a workout's supposed to be one day and you have to next day. Even this week, for example, I was supposed to do a big track workout on Wednesday, 12 by 800. And we were going to go to, there's a great high school track right across the street from our office. So we left work a few minutes early, you know, we warmed up, did a couple miles, ran over to the track, and there was a track meet going on. So like, okay, well, that's not going to work. So we're like, all right, the car, we drove, jogged to the high school in Marblehead where we live, and there was another track meet going on.
Wow.
So we're like, all right, okay, today's not going to be our day. You know, we'll just run easy. We got up yesterday morning and, you know, did it just fine. And I think, you know, because he's there and he's able to give me that immediate feedback and kind of that flexibility, you know, I think that's valuable. And obviously, I'm sure with your coaching, you know, you understand that sometimes lives are unpredictable and schedules change. And so it's just, you know, kind of being amenable to that and not just freaking out and saying, you know, if I can't do it on Wednesday, then I'm just going to give up for the week. It's like, well, you know, be creative and think of, you know, could I have maybe just done a fartlek or something on the road, or, you know, should I postpone it like I did to the next day or something like that? I think, you know, oftentimes we get so rigid with our schedules, and that's obviously valuable and important, you know, to have that schedule and to stick with it. But at the same time, you know, just knowing that life is unpredictable, it's not always going to go the way that you want, it's not always under your control, and you just have to make the most of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a big part of training in general. I mean, even when, you know, I was running professionally and that was pretty much the only thing I had to do all day, you know, it didn't always go perfect. You know, things came up. and having being adaptable, because I know a lot of times athletes struggle with that. They have that one bad workout or that things just whatever they just ruins their. So I think it's great that you put that. It's an important thing to just let it roll off you and either be creative or move on. You know, put it behind you. What would you say struggle is? You know, that you have with your training, like on a day-to-day basis.
I think, you know, sometimes motivation levels can be low, especially when you're doing what feels like the same thing every day. I am fortunate, again, you know, with Jordan, who is my coach, but, you know, he's also my boyfriend and he's also my roommate. So, you know, if he's getting up to go run at 6 a.m, I'm not just going to roll over and not get up to go run. Like, I think the same can be true if you have a running partner. You know, when I lived in Charlotte, if I knew Caitlin was meeting me in Freedom Park at 6:15, I wasn't going to not show up in Freedom Park. So I think, you know, that can be overcome by having that sort of built-in accountability or that built-in motivation with a spouse or a training partner or something like that. I think, you know, running can be a struggle when you feel like you're having great workouts and not necessarily having races that reflect that. That's something I'm dealing with a little bit this spring. I've just had a couple races in a row that, you know, both of them, you know, nothing disastrous, but just neither one felt like they, you know, they really were indicative or reflective of what my training had shown. One in particular, actually, I raced at the Penn Relays last weekend, last Thursday in the 10K. And again, it was one of those where I'd set up, you know, my tier of goals, like, here's what I want to do, best case scenario, you know, perfectly acceptable, last resort goal. And then ultimately, the time I ended up running didn't achieve any of those goals. It was slower than I'd even, like, even entertain the idea in my mind would be the time that I would run. And so, you know, that was pretty disappointing and pretty deflating. But, you know, and I had another couple of solid days of pouting after that. But, you know, interestingly, that same weekend was the Peyton Jordan Invitational. So, you know, of course, a lot of us were glued to our computers, you know, hitting refresh and watching races. And it was interesting, a girl from Charlotte originally, Julia Lucas, ran a huge PR in the 5K. She ran 15:08. I think her previous PR was something in the 15:30s. And afterwards, you know, she was interviewed and she said, you know, it was 8 years ago or 7 years ago in college when I ran 15:50. And it's been 5 years since I ran 15:30. But I knew that, you know, every workout and every race and every struggle, you know, has been building up to me having this breakthrough today. Mm-hmm. And that really resonated with me. I feel kind of silly, you know, to be so upset about having one or two bad performances that are just isolated to a single season when, you know, if you look at that, you know, that was an 8 or 10 year progression where, you know, she had a lot of injuries, she had a lot of setbacks, and I'm sure, you know, a dozen times thought about, you know, why am I doing this? Up? Should I move on? And she stuck with it and had that perseverance. And, you know, she could very well be on our Olympic team, you know, in the next couple months with a performance like that. And she, you know, she kept that goal and just believed in the process and knew that, you know, overall, it was going to eventually produce the result. And for me, it's a very timely lesson because I'm kind of struggling with that right now. And so I think it's important to see that the process is going great. You know, I'm healthy, which is obviously number one most important.
Right.
I'm running, you know, I'm consistently running the mileage I want to run. I'm getting in good workouts. You know, the results haven't shown that yet. But, you know, I do trust that, you know, you kind of have to just know that you're going to get there eventually and that, you know, another performance is around the corner.
Yeah. I think that's a great point, and I'm glad you brought it up because so many people struggle with that, you know, and I think one thing, when you're going through it, you kind of think that no one is going through that, you know, you always look at other people and you're thinking, well, there's always you always see them improving and you always, or at least you think they're improving. And so it's difficult.
You see what you want to see. So you always see the people who are running well. You don't know the people who are also struggling, you know?
Right, exactly. You never see people that are struggling. They, you know, it doesn't get highlighted too often when somebody runs a bad race. You know, it's not broadcast on Runner's World when somebody runs a terrible race. And so I think it's a good point. A lot of people struggle with that. and I think it sounds like for you, a lot of it's the confidence part is keeping your confidence and keeping the trust in what you're doing and that it eventually things are going to come through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Well, that's, I guess to wrap things up, I guess I wanted to ask, you know, over the last few years, you know, especially coming, you know, you're fairly rapid ascension to being a, you know, a pretty good elite runner. You know, what would be the biggest thing, biggest lesson that you've learned along the way that's kind of helped kind of make that jump?
I think I don't know if it's the biggest, but certainly one of the ones that has been the most impactful for me is just not limiting yourself or not setting expectations and just assuming that that's as good as it's going to get. You know, I think when I was an 1830 5K runner, you know, I was pretty 1830 5K runner because I didn't see any scenario in which it would be possible for me to run faster than that. You know, I felt like, sure, you know, I run a decent amount. You know, I do a couple workouts. Like, when I run 1830, it's really hard. So, like, that's what my capability is, you know. And
right.
I think, you know, again, you know, people like you and Coach Simmons believing in me and really encouraging me to not set limits for myself has been, you know, has really been life-changing in that sense. You know, it automatically has just shown me that, you know, if I can run 1630 and 3430, maybe I can run 16 minutes and 3330. Or, you know, if I can run 241, why can't, you know, in 3 or 4 years, why can't I run 235? Like, there's nothing about me inherently that's different. I'm the same person that I was 5 years ago. You know, it's just been the continuous, the dedication and the improvement. And I think just the reevaluating the mindset. You know, I ran 35:05 at Penn Relays, and, you know, even in early 2010, I would have been thrilled to run that time. You know,
right,
it's just
right.
My expectations have changed. You know, my goals have changed. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's okay to be disappointed to run that type of time, even though it's not a bad time necessarily, because that just shows that, you know, I'm setting the bar higher and I'm recognizing that, you know, I can be as good as I want to be. You know, I think that's an important lesson for anyone. You know, that may
yeah.
not be the same for every person. You know, certainly we do all have limits, you know, but I think too often we just get complacent, or you know, we tend to look at people who are running faster than us and just sort of in awe, or almost, you know, set them apart as like, well, they're different than me, or, you know, they're more talented than me, they're faster than me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not necessarily any difference between those people, or between someone like me and, you know, someone who might be watching this. Like,
right.
I was just, you know, a very average, you know, just kind of age group runner a while ago. And you just kind of reassess what your limits are and encourage yourself to just keep pushing past them.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think that's phenomenal advice. I'm glad you said it. So yeah, I guess the last thing, talk a little bit about Crowdo. I think their brands, they're very great. They're great running brands, but I don't think they're as popular as, you know, the Nike and the Reebok and that kind of stuff. So talk a little bit about kind of what you guys have for products, what you do, what your mission is.
Oh yeah, thank you for asking. Crowdo is a really neat brand, and I'll confess that, you know, before I was working in the running industry, I'd never heard of them either. We sometimes say, you know, it's the best brand you've never heard of. It's a Finnish company, and the brand's been around actually for almost 100 years. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is, you know, back in the early 20th century, the Flying, the ones that people, Panermi and Lasse Värin and all those guys, they wore Karhu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wore Karhu on the, they had, you know, boss champions that wore Karhu, a rich history and a legacy to the brand that a lot of people don't realize. And actually Boston Marathon, that was last month,
mm-hmm.
A couple weeks ago, we flew over the 1972 winner of the Boston Marathon, who was a Finnish gentleman who wore Karhu, you know, in the 70s. And it was just neat to get his perspective and hear about, you know, the brand in Finland is spoken as reverentially as a Nike or something like that. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
people who do a lot within the fitness industry, in terms of just, you know, same as a Brooks or a Nike or something like that, in the sense that, you know, we're wanting to be in running specialty stores. We're wanting to that specialty runner. But, you know, again, I think it's to hear the history that we have. We actually just bought our CEO just bought a 1976, 1974 Argosy Ailer. We totally innovated into a mobile. It's a museum of footwear, of Karhu. We've got some really neat things in it. And we're actually accepting applications for people to drive it around the country this fall. We're doing like a tour.
Wow.
So, I would, you know, we're looking for people who want to run and live the dream and sort of spread the message about Karhu around the country. Karhu means bear in Finnish. So we have a bear as, you know, our logo on things. We may or may not will dress up in a bear at some of our events, just kind of trying to embrace that side of it. But our website's calm, K-A-U, so I'd love for people to learn more about it.
Spell it out slowly. Have this translated.
Yeah,
so
it's karhu.com.
Okay.
And if you want to learn more about the tour, it's karhu.com/runnerswanted. You can apply. We're taking video applications. You can apply to live the dream for a couple months in this fall and drive the Airstream around. And then Craft, just briefly, Craft is our partner apparel brand. It's okay. Most well known probably in cycling. We sponsor Team Radio Shack Nissan Trek, which is the Schleck brothers and Fabian Cancellara and arguably team in the world. And the Tour de France is on the summer. You'll see Craft on, you know, on all the riders there.
Awesome.
We're also, it's a Swedish brand in heritage. So we do a Nordic a lot with cross-country skiing and that type of thing. So that's probably where we're most well-known. But we also make, you know, great running apparel.
Awesome. Cool. Well, again, Megan, thanks for taking the time out of your day to talk with us and teach us some great lessons about kind of, you know, taking that next step with your in your racing. And everybody enjoyed. And check out the blog. It's greenlightningrunning.blogspot.com. Is that correct?
Yep, get that right? Correct. Yep, Green
All
Lightning.
All right, we'll throw a link up at the bottom of this video, and you can check it out. Megan's actually a phenomenal writer. If you enjoy reading about running, especially workouts and stuff, Megan details things pretty extensively, so check it out. It's pretty good. So thanks again, Megan.
Thanks, Steph. I appreciate it.
Yeah.